You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. Hey, who's not a true fan of true crime? Well, perhaps there's a few people out there, but many of the people that I know really relish the idea of being able to pick up a book or read a story about true crime. Well, that's exactly what we've got this week. My guest is author and Vanity Fair correspondent Joe Pompeo. His new book is Blood and Ink, and the subtitle is really what caught my eye, The Scandalous Jazz Age, and I emphasize Jazz Age Double Murder that Hooked America on True Crime. And we're talking about a couple, and this going back 100 years down in New Jersey, a crime to this day that has not been solved, one Reverend Edward Hall and an Eleanor Mills, who sang in the choir at Reverend Hall's church. And we're going to let Joe for the next half hour talk about what intrigued him, what caught his attention to want to put the whole story between the pages of a book. Hey, Joe, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you first and foremost, are you a true crime fan to begin with?
Yeah, I am, and specifically historical true crime. That's sort of the true crime books I read are all in that genre, older stuff, and pretty old. Like I love especially the 1800s and 19th century, and you know, this book was even a little later in the time period than I initially was kind of hoping to tackle, but. Yeah, I read, you know, all that sort of stuff. People always cite, you know, Devil in the White City is sort of one of the canonical releases in this genre. But I listen to some, you know, some when there's a big, you know, contemporary true crime production. Obviously, I listen to Serial like everyone else, and you know, certain documentaries and series like that. But really, in terms of my reading, historical true crime is what I really gravitate towards.
Now, I imagine some folks would say, well, geez, why not reopen or take another stab at, the Amelia Earhart disappearance or the Jimmy Hoffa disappearance? You know, those are sort of names that resonate with folks and have for many years. How did you ever come up with, this case taking place in New Jersey back 100 years ago? How do you even go about finding out that this even existed?
Well, the funny thing is, you know, this took place in New Brunswick, New Jersey, in central New Jersey. It's where Johnson & Johnson is headquartered, was founded and is still headquartered to this day. And it's also where Rutgers University is located. And I went to Rutgers, quite a few years ago now. So I lived in New Brunswick, the town where this story unfolds for 4 years. I'd never heard of it in school, even though this is sort of a story that is embedded in the local lore of the town. But years later, when I was 18 years later, in fact, so it was 2018 when I started casting about for a book, I was catching up with a graduate school professor, not from Rutgers, but from, I went to graduate school at Columbia Journalism School, and I was catching up with this woman named Andy Tucker, who runs the communications PhD program there, but also teaches, you know, some history of journalism lectures. And when I took her courses at Columbia, you know, we studied some of these crimes that I was talking about when you first asked me. I loved some of these stories, like the murder of Helen Jewett in the 1800s, the Mary Rogers case, which famously Edgar Allan Poe based one of the short stories on. So I went back to this professor where we had sort of studied some of these sort of crimes, and I was just sort of spitballing because I knew I was looking for a book to pursue of my own. And to your point, you know, some of these really, really famous ones, they're kind of well picked over. You know, you can, if you have a really good, fresh, new angle, you could certainly, like, you know, reapproach, you know, one of these more famous crimes. I mean, there's always new and interesting things coming out about the Jack the Ripper murders or whatnot. But ideally, you want to find something that, you know, has a lot of meat on the bone, but hasn't been picked over too much, and that, you know, people aren't really too familiar with. So we were talking about, you know, different murders from history, and at one point she just mentioned the Hall Mills murders, and had a nice ring to it on its face. But then she mentioned, and that, you know, down in New Brunswick, and since I had gone to school there, I was just immediately interested. And, you know, we separately were also talking about the emergence of the tabloid press in the 1920s and just how, like, over the top and outrageous those newspapers were at the time. So, like, I left this conversation with kind of a distinct impression that those two things were the makings of something, and that's where it started.
And you know, Joey, I mean, you know, I'm obviously not a writer, but I guess if I were, as you said, looking for that diamond in the rough, this certainly would be it. And it has all the elements. I'm sure as a first year journalist student, it'd be one of the first things that the instructor would tell you is look for something that's the diamond in the rough. Make sure it has all the, you know, has all the makings of a real exciting story. And this one does, a century-old murder. One that is still ongoing, the death of a minister and his choir singing Lover. So let me ask you outright, was this a love triangle kind of story?
You know, love triangle might be not quite the right term. I think this was, you know, it was more a story about, you know, two individuals who were in both in sort of unsatisfying marriages and were seeking something in this affair that they weren't getting from their marriages. And, you know, both, you know, in marriages that had already sort of, by all accounts, dissolved, you know, so there was, you know, there wasn't like, neither victim was like hot to trot with their spouse, you know, at the same time that they were pursuing this affair. But certainly, like, you know, just in terms of, you know, scandal or a really salacious element, I mean, like you said, the fact that this was, you know, a minister who had married into a very wealthy family, having this love affair with a woman who also married a member of his choir and someone who was from, you know, a lower social class. This is a working class woman, you know, sort of semi impoverished. And I mean, those elements, I think, even a little more juicy than the typical love triangle angle, perhaps.
And I got to assume, like any situation where you're talking about, you know, couples, it's just not working out, and you try to find that that desire, those needs, those things that another person can give you, at least emotionally, and that certainly seems to be the case here. And I don't want to give away the book because I, you know, people should go out and buy the book and read it for themselves because there's a whole lot between, you know, the cover and the end of the book, quite a bit of the whole story, putting it together. But again, would it be fair to say that one of the underlying themes is jealousy?
You know, I think, you know, there's a lot of jealousy in the book, but I think more so, again, because these were two people who, you know, were kind of in these marriages that hadn't worked. You know, it's more about, I think that there was jealousy in this church around this woman, Eleanor Mills, because she had become such a close associate and confidant of this charismatic, well-liked minister. And that fueled a certain amount of, you know, resentment and gossip and intrigue as this affair was taking place and heating up, and, you know, sort of below the surface, everyone, as it would come out in the newspapers after these murders, everyone sort of knew about it. And I think because you had this situation where you had this woman who was the star of the choir, had become this favorite of the minister, she was influential in his inner circle, had a certain amount of influence over him, that definitely, you know, allowed this sort of jealousy to fester amongst, you know, other and members of the choir, especially other women within the choir. And that sort of, you know, in a way, you know, became a factor in this whole thing and a factor in the investigation into the murders.
The other thing I'm thinking, Joe, is that, you know, we're talking 100 years ago. Let's fast forward this and assume that these two people are here with us today, and the same kind of ending unfolds. Today we're in a 24/7 news cycle. Everything, I mean, you sneeze and somebody knows about it somewhere on social media. Somehow it's out there. I mean, people just, you know, they just fill themselves with gossip and stories and everything else. Because it was 100 years ago, because there was no 24/7 news cycle, and probably the only way you got reports of something like this was through local newspapers. So did that add to the fact that to this day, it was still an unknown story? Because at the time of it happening, there just wasn't a lot of interest in something like that, or the news didn't spread fast enough.
You know, actually, it's one of the fascinating things is that this, you know, at this time, at the time of the murders, this it pretty much immediately became a national sensation. And you know, even though there was no internet, there was a lot of newspapers. There were morning newspapers. There were evening newspapers. New York City alone had something like, you know, 10 newspapers or at the time. There was newswires. I mean, this pretty much quickly ricocheted all over the country. As I did, go through the newspaper coverage from every single day and multiple newspapers, and you realize how much information about this is leaking out into the press. And especially, you know, my book focuses, on the tabloid newspapers that were emerging. But even the New York Times, you know, which is this large broadsheet, I mean, the New York Times had like almost like a novel every single day in its pages about this story. There was so much interest, so much frenzy around this. It really became one of these media spectacles. And I think that was characteristic of the 1920s and the Jazz Age. You know, people gravitated toward these sorts of sensations that became a national obsession, whether it was crime and murder and scandal, or whether it was, sort of competitive sports or just, you know, general trivialities and movie stars and celebrity. And I mean, these were all things that I think began to define the decade after people were emerging from this darker period of war and a flu pandemic, and were just looking, you know, for fun. And I think the newspapers, even though we don't, you know, these are just a story about murder, it's unfortunate and tragic, but at the same time, this was something that for the newspaper reading public was exciting. It was fun, and the newspapers, like especially the tabloid press, presented it in this fun and thrilling way. So really, you know, even by the standard of the 1920s, when you just still had newspapers, it's amazing how quickly something like this could catch fire.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. I want to take a quick pause to remind folks that you tune to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner. This is this week's edition of The Public Eye, and I'm joined by Vanity Fair correspondent and author Joe Pompeo. His new book is Blood and Ink, The Scandalous Jazz Age Double Murder That Hooked America on True Crime. We're talking about a one Reverend Edward Hall and Eleanor Mills, a singer in the Reverend's church choir, and their romance that ended up in both of them being murdered. And here we are 100 years later, and as Joe has been talking about, and he's put the story between the pages of his new book, this murder is still unsolved. Joe, does that surprise you that with all the technology today and, you know, in fact, I think just recently I was coming across a couple of stories where DNA was able to once again, identify someone who's been on the lam for 20, 30, 40 years. So are you surprised that after 100 years, this, especially in New Brunswick, New Jersey, okay, it's not a small town, but nonetheless, people there, activity. Are you surprised that there has not been some new evidence or a break that would have put everything into perspective?
You know, one of the things about this case is that it was sort of doomed from the start. New Brunswick was, you know, something of sort of mini metropolis at the time, and it was kind of a bustling hub of industry and academia, but the bodies, they were found sort of on the outskirts of town in this field right over the border in this more rural county, Somerset County, which at the time was you know, smaller, a sort of smaller town, even more provincial area than New Brunswick was. And there was a certain level of jurisdictional confusion between the authorities in these two counties. But even both of them, you know, it was Somerset that took over the case because the bodies, you know, were found in Somerset County and they determined they were ultimately killed there. So this really was a small town, rural sort of police force that was ultimately in the driver's seat for this. And, you know, so this is not, even at the time, forensics was still in its infancy. But certainly this is not the NYPD, you know, were the ones who took control of the crime scene. And the authorities from the very beginning, you know, one of the, I think, key things about this case is that, you know, the crime scene was just like corrupted from the moment that the police took control over it. I mean, there were no photos taken. You know, crowds descended very quickly and pretty much just went wild, stomping around the body, picking up evidence, and you know, they didn't even do proper autopsies. Before the bodies were interred, they would subsequently do two exhumations over the coming 4 years that this case unfolded. So really, you know, in terms of, there was no murder weapon recovered. They didn't have any concrete physical evidence really to work with. There was one piece of physical evidence, this calling card of the Reverend's that was, you know, had been placed near his foot when the bodies were found, that later, you know, they found a fingerprint on, and, you know, that was the one piece of sort of actual forensics that they had to maybe link someone to this crime. But that's still, you know, it was still a comparatively weak piece of evidence. And, you know, I think when you have something like that from the start where, you know, there's just no, you know, all the things you're supposed to do to secure a crime scene and, preserve the evidence, when that's not done, it makes it very difficult, let alone in the year 1922, when forensics are not that advanced to begin with. So really this case, it was, you know, all about more circumstantial evidence and witness testimony and, you know, pretty uncredible witness testimony. So, you know, I'm not too surprised because, you know, the case just didn't, you know, get off to a good start. And, you know, none of the people from this case, none of the main players had, you know, children, you know, so there's no like great grandchild that might have, you know, that might find, right, the, you know, someone's diary in a trunk that would have some clue in it that could, you know, hold the smoking gun or the key to the mystery. But there are people, you know, there's a Facebook group devoted to reinvestigating this case where these people who are, you know, who's highly interested in it, you know, kind of exchange theories and, you know, some people in that group really would like, I think they believe or hope that, you know, somehow maybe a murder weapon will turn up or something else that could bring this back. But it's sort of kind of strange credulity to think that might actually happen. But, you know, you never say never. And I think, you know, people are still trying to solve, as I said, you know, Jack the Ripper murder, and there's still, you know, some, you know, compelling new theories that emerge. So, you know, I think for me, I'm kind of drawn to the enduring mystery and the unknowableness. You mentioned like Amelia Earhart at the top of the hour, and, you know, would we still be so fascinated with Amelia Earhart if it was conclusively determined what happened to her, you know, by some miraculous turn of events tomorrow? To me, we wouldn't be as fascinated. So as much as I think it would be, you know, utterly riveting and thrilling to see this solved, I also think there's power in the fact that it's unsolved.
Yeah, and I have to agree with you. I think the lapse of time, the lack of any additional concrete information, the lack of, as you said, the lineage, family members, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, whatever it may be, Because oftentimes somebody has the wherewithal, and usually a family member has the desire to put it to rest, to give the family some closure. In this case, the were, like you said, on either side there were no children, and no legacy. And again, at the time, as you just talked about, the investigation was botched from the beginning, so that certainly didn't help matters. Which brings me to the next question then. Obviously, after doing the research, getting the book published, you must have some thoughts of your own. In your view, not holding your feet to the fire, but are you willing to at least come forward with what you think happened to both of these people?
Yeah, I sort of hinted this at the in the end in my epilogue, and I will say too, there's some, we talk about these years after the fact, sometimes some new lead or piece of evidence emerges. There was one moment where something like that did happen with this case, and that's a twist in the book as well, where some, I think 47 years after the murder, some new witness emerges, some person emerges with some new information, which is fascinating and intriguing and compelling. And, but again, there was not like conclusive resolution based on that, but it is one of those moments where there something does kind of emerge years after the fact. In terms of my own beliefs or conclusions about who did this, I mean, what I would say is, throughout the case, and not giving away too much about this case to say that ultimately the people who became the main suspects, the main people of interest in this investigation, and the people who were ultimately brought to trial, it was the widow of the murdered minister and her two brothers and a cousin. And again, these were people from this very wealthy, prominent, influential family. They were kind of like, the Boston Brahmins of New Brunswick, New Jersey,
yeah,
at the time. So certainly motive, means, all that stuff is there. And, there was always throughout the case so much smoke around this family, so for me, like, the old expression, where there's smoke, there's fire. I tend to think, without being able to say for sure, that when I look at this case and I look at all of the smoke, even if it's all circumstantial, or, again, none of it is a concrete piece of physical evidence, it just seems to me that there must be something there. Now, there's people who disagree. I think there's a school of thought that, along the same lines, that the widower, the cuckolded widower, Jim Mills, who was the husband of Eleanor Mills, the murdered choir singer, should have been a much more closely looked at suspect yeah, throughout all this. There's a guy named the author, I don't know if you know the author, Bill James, who is sort of renowned statistician, and he did a book about true crime, where he, looked at famous crimes or unsolved crimes throughout history and approached it through this sort of, through his lens of statistics and reason and what's obvious. And he comes down in this book firmly on Jim Mills, the husband. I think that one of the tricky things about this case is that there's so much, everything about the crime is so bizarre and bewildering, that, even with, if you land on one theory, there's always something where you could say, but what about this,
right,
and something to undercut. So even with my theory, there are things that I could sort of play devil's advocate and sort of undercut and start to talk myself out of it. But at the end of the day, I think that's kind of what I say in the book, which hopefully, if your readers get to the end of it, they'll be able to read this in a much more eloquent way than I'm saying it now. But ultimately, I feel like too much smoke around this one family for there not to have been,
have a hand
a little
in,
bit
yeah,
of fire.
Yeah, and that's And that's usually the case. But as you said, between the time that it has elapsed since then, the way it was botched from the beginning by investigators and local police, we may never know. And that what really adds to the, I think, the mystique of reading a book about true crime. And I think that's probably what inspired Joe to write Blood and Ink, the scandalous Jazz Age double murder that hooked America on true crime, a 100-year-old crime that took place in New Jersey. And Joe has really done a lot of research and putting it together between the pages of the book. Again, the book is widely available, Blood and Ink. Joe, if people want to pose questions to you directly, just get more information about your work, how might they do that?
You should have a website. They can go to bloodand.ink, and that's also the kind of a dummy URL that will just go to redirect you to joepompeo.net. And that, you know, is kind of my landing page for the book that has everything from a link where people can sign up for my newsletter, where I'm sort of doing, you know, running some bonus content and things like that, as well as recommendations for other new releases in the historical true crime and narrative history genre, all the stuff it sounds like you are also a fan of and bring authors on to discuss on this show. And then I'm also on Twitter, at Joe Pompeo. Just my name, and those are probably the best places to, catch up on the latest about this book and see what I'm thinking.
And as Joe has stated, and I said it at the outset, this is true crime. This is not a fiction. This actually took place in one of those instances that never became widespread to this day, anyway, as Joe talked about earlier. Made, you know, all the major newspapers in the area at the time, but today has become somewhat forgotten. And I have to say that, Joe. I love to, you know, find these little diamonds in the rough. And no, there may never be a closure on all of this, but the fact of the matter is that someone like yourself has brought it to light and shed new light on a story. And the best part for you listeners and for readers is to pick up the book and, to determine for yourself after you finish the book, you know, who was the guilty party or who could have been the guilty party, what motivations would have been there. And that's the part we all find so interesting and so thrilling. Again, the book is Blood and Ink. My guest has been Joe Pompeo, the scandalous Jazz Age double murder that hooked America on true crime. If you have any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.